let me just, first of all, just get your thoughts on this now 2-year anniversary since the terrorist attack here and all the history that led up to this. Kind of how do you view this situation?
History did not start on October 7th. And that is unfortunately the way that many still view it. Certainly, if you read an American media report or watch an American media story, the implication is that things were going well, that there was peace, that there was no occupation, that there was no apartheid, that, as you noted in your report there, that hundreds of Palestinians hadn't been killed in Gaza and the West Bank in the months in 2023 prior to October 7th. You know, 2023 was the most violent year for the Palestinians prior to October 7th in decades since the Second Intifada. I was able to go to Palestine last year, visited the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and this is November of 2024. If people recall, in the spring of 2023, leading up to October 7th, you had violent mob attacks by Israelis on the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and they heavily damaged the mosque. And when I was there 18 months later, the windows, the doors were still broken. The walls were still damaged. The Israelis refused to allow the Palestinians to repair the mosque. But can you imagine that type of affront, that type of insult, that type of attack on a people, such as what the Israelis had done in 2023, whether it was just the violence of the Israeli army and the settlers, whether it was things like the mob attack on the Al-Aqsa Mosque, whether it was the pogroms that were occurring throughout the West Bank as settlers backed by the Israeli military burned Palestinian villages. So to your point exactly, what did people expect the Palestinians to do? And under international law, and I would add also as well, natural law, a people have a right to resist. And so while I agree with you about the attacks on October 7th that killed hundreds of civilians being war crimes and reprehensible, as well as strategically counterproductive, the attacks by the Palestinians on the Israeli military and security forces, the people that were keeping them in what was effectively a concentration camp, were justified. You know, I mean, if you're an occupying power, you have to assume the risk of an attack by those you're occupying. And that's what happened on October 7th. But now here we are 2 years later, and I'm sure we could go back and look at what you and I said about this 2 years ago. I'm sure we talked about this, right? The idea, though, that we would have seen what we saw, I think everyone, were in agreement that the Israelis were going to take October 7th for what they could use it for, that October 7th was giving them the opportunity to carry out and fulfill what was started in 1948 and what was continued in 1967, the Nakba and the Naxa, which you covered there, those ethnic cleansing campaigns, and that now was a chance.
And then, Matt, if you could, because I was short on time and actually didn't have the Naxa. Some people don't even know there's a difference between this. What was the Naxa, if you could?
Sure. The Naxa is the Palestinian term for the 1967 war, the campaign launched by the Israelis. Israelis fully admit the only people that seem to think that somehow the Israelis were launching a preemptive war are those who have such a superficial knowledge of this. It's embarrassing, which means most of the American media and most of the American politicians. But, you know, in 1967, Israel launched the 1967 war, and they took large parts of the West Bank. They took Jerusalem, and they took Gaza. And during that campaign, hundreds of thousands of people were expelled from their homes. Many were forced to go into exile in throughout the region, whether it be Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, into other parts of the West Bank or into Gaza. And it was a campaign that was premeditated, it was planned, and it reflected the desire of the Israelis to continue what was started in 1948 with the Nakba. And Naxa simply means, whereas Nakba means catastrophe, Naxa means roughly little catastrophe or continuing catastrophe.
Let me kind of put this in context here. I want to put up a map here that shows what the region looked like in 1946 all the way through to 1999. And it's not a whole lot different from that lesson. But you see there the dark areas were where the Palestinians lived, the land that they had, and the white areas where the Jews were. So as I mentioned, the Jews have been there since at least 1920, maybe a little bit before that. But at least from what I've read, relatively copacetic in how they lived together until things started changing in 1947. And then you see and then after the 1967, which you just mentioned, you see yet more white, yet less of the area that where the Palestinians lived. And then by 1999 today, it's just almost dots in what's known as the West Bank. And then that strip there in Gaza. So you can see that the people were progressively ripped off their lands. And you just got to understand how any people would feel if that's what they'd been done over all those decades.
Right. And demographically, you saw such a major change in Palestine during people's lifetimes. You know, so starting in 1900, the Jewish population was roughly about 2% of Palestine, and about 40% of those Jews were immigrants. So you go back into the 19th century and you're looking at a Jewish population of roughly 1% or so. And then the 1920s, you're at 7 or 8% Jewish population. In the 1930s, it passes 20%. And then you get to 1947, where the population, the Jewish population is about 500,000 and roughly one third approaching 40% of the population there. So you see this massive demographic swing in Palestine as a result, for no other reason than the immigration that came from Europe. And as you said, certainly I think anyone who's reasonable can understand the need for Jews in Europe to have fled, to have wanted to have a place of their own. You know, following World War II, of course, that migration greatly increases. You go from, again, about 500,000 Jews in Palestine in 1947 to well over 1 million by the early 50s. And now, of course, there's about 7.5 million, 8 million Jews in Israel and as well as in Palestine as well. But that demographic shift, anyone can imagine what type of pressures that put on. So as immigrants from as Jewish immigrants from Europe arrived daily, weekly, monthly, they did purchase land, but also too, as they grew in power and size, they began to seize land. And so it starts really in the 19th century, but by the 1920s, you're seeing real violence occurring between the Jews and the Palestinians. And when I say Palestinians, I mean both the majority Muslims and the minority Christians. What happens, of course, after 1948 is that most of the Christians leave. Most of the Christians flee. Flee the country in a way and go to other countries, as opposed to the Palestinian Muslims, who either were forcibly relocated within historic Palestine, or as I said before, went to places like Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, etc. But I mean, so when you go back to if Gary could put that map back up again, if you go back to the partition plan in 1948, you know, and you understand that in 46, that's what it looks like. And Jews are about a third of the population. And then you see what the plan is. And what you see in 47 is essentially the United Nations plan. And you're saying, wait, hang on a second. A third of the population is going to get about 60% of the land, including some of the most arable or usable, certainly along the coast, those types of things. You say, this makes no sense. That's not fair. Who would ever accept that deal? And that's essentially what happens. And people who are interested in this, read about what occurs in the newborn United Nations, the bullying, the hostility, the force used by particularly the United States to push through Israeli statehood over the objections of many countries. You have to remember the United Nations at that time was much smaller. The countries that were to gain independence from things like the British Empire had not been seated in the United Nations left yet. So when people talk about 1948, the United Nations did this and that, you have to put it in the context of how bad a deal it was, how crooked the actual procedure was in the United Nations to get that deal through, who actually was present in the United Nations at that time, you know, and that,
Great point, right?
And when you understand that, you begin to understand, I think, the larger context or background of what has been occurring and how these are grievances held by the Palestinians that are real. I mean, you go back to say, okay, speed up to 1967. The Israelis take large parts of the Palestinian areas, destroy hundreds of villages, expel hundreds of thousands of people. Modern day Gaza, you have roughly 3/4 of the population of Gaza, maybe more, are those descendants. The mass majority of the population in Gaza are refugees. And so what you have happening on October 7th then is those towns and villages that were attacked by the Palestinians on that day, many of those who were attacking those villages had parents or grandparents who had originally lived in those villages. So there's a real historic cycle here that goes beyond the academic and the intellectual, but the personal. You can imagine that as they assigned who was going to attack who, the Palestinian men who carried out these attacks, if they could, would have wanted to attack and go into the villages and towns, again, where their parents and their grandparents had been forcibly expelled from, right? So there's a personal aspect of this for the Palestinians that can't that can't be ignored. A symbol you see in Palestine constantly of this, you know, of this issue about the right of return, the right of the Palestinians to go back to their home, is the key. And you see the key constantly because Palestinians actually still have the keys to the homes that they were kicked out of in the 40s, that they were kicked out of in the 60s, right? That they're being kicked out of now in the West Bank. This is an issue where the history is tied so closely with the personal lives, with the familial lives of the Palestinians that, it's something that doesn't get enough attention or discussion of in the West. And I think it's the type of thing where, of course, you know, it's that issue of put yourself in their shoes. What would you do?
Yeah. And that's what too few people do. They don't even know what shoes to get into. In the amount of time we have left here, I want a real quick run to where all this is at now. And one of the maps that was posted actually by President Trump on Truth Social a couple of days ago, he said, this is the first objective. Gary, if you could put that yellow line map up there. He said, this is where the Israelis might withdraw to. So we saw on the bigger maps there, this tiny little strip, what is the Gaza Strip in comparison with the whole of Israel. Now you see what they're even talking about right now is to shrink it down even further to just what's in that enclave surrounded by that yellow line. And maybe Israel agrees to it, maybe they don't. But I wonder if you can kind of give us a sense of what you think the Palestinian people will think about this deal.
Oh, we know. I mean, there's been public opinion polls that show, you know, late last week, only 8% of the Palestinians in Gaza supported it. Of course, they have no reason to trust the Israelis or the Americans. And why should they? As soon as Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu announced this deal, Benjamin Netanyahu speaks in Hebrew to his fellow Israelis and say, our troops aren't leaving Gaza and they'll never be a Palestinian state. I mean, right away, not even like a decent interval of a day or two. I mean, immediately. I mean, and let alone the history, things we've discussed, you know, many times before, why should the Palestinians trust this?
He had said he had pounded on the lectern on his speech at the UN General Assembly and I unequivocally said there will be no Palestinian state. That would be the ultimate reward for 10/7, et cetera. And yet in that 20-point peace plan allegedly crafted by Witkoff and the Trump administration, it says that there has to be a possibility for a Palestinian state. And then you're saying that coming out of that, in English, he didn't actually address that part. He addressed other things which were negative. But then you're saying in Hebrew, right after that, he reiterated what he said at the UNGA.
Exactly. Exactly. As well as the fact that Israeli troops are not leaving Gaza. And that's not just Netanyahu. That, you know, his perspective, his views, that is the perspective and views and desires of the Israeli body politic and the vast majority of Israeli civilians. There is no one of any political significance in Israel, Israeli Jewish political significance, who is calling for the removal of the troops or establishment of a Palestinian state. There are some, but they're not. They have, again, no political significance. And you've seen the way the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, has spoken on this issue. They have been firm. All the Israeli Jewish Knesset members have been clear, no statehood, and the vast majority of them want to see the genocide, the ethnic cleansing carried out to the end. I believe whether or not the deal holds, it results in the same for the Palestinians as we've been seeing. I mean, I think you see essentially if the deal doesn't hold, the Israelis continue with their ethnic cleansing campaign. They are essentially where they were about a year ago before they stopped what was called the General's Plan to cleanse the North, before they were stopped in their efforts at that by the January 2025 ceasefire, which was coincided with Donald Trump's inauguration. Many people believe that was the purpose in it, was Trump was trying to put his fingerprints on it for his own ego purposes, because once the Israelis violated and ended that ceasefire in March 2025, Trump, of course, was happy about it, went along with it, did nothing to stop it. I mean, it's not even close to stopping it, you know, egged it on. And now what we see now, and if people want to doubt me, I'll just say you haven't been paying attention to this man we have as president. You have, of course, at the end of the week, the Nobel Peace Prize is going to be announced. And this seems so fantastic, right, Danny? It seems so farcical. It seems like the most absurd satire that the president of the United States would put the screws, would be hard on Benjamin Netanyahu, right, for a reason that pertains to him getting the Nobel Peace Prize. And so the my view is that when a Nobel Peace Prize is awarded at the end of the week and Donald Trump doesn't get it, you'll see either an immediate Israeli resumption of their ethnic cleansing campaign, of the genocide, or they'll provide a decent interval. They'll give it a week or two or 3 weeks, and there'll be some excuse as to start it again. And they'll blame the Palestinians, of course, for, you know, restarting it as they do. You know, if you watch like the American spokespeople, if you watch Tammy Bruce, the spokesperson for the State Department, she will say that Hamas violated the ceasefire and ended the cease, and they're the ones who ended the ceasefire in March, not the Israelis. I mean, just absolutely crazy, upside down, bizarro, non-factual statements. But that's what they'll do. They'll stick to their narrative. But the point being, I feel, is that if the deal fails, back to the ethnic cleansing, back to what they were trying to accomplish last year, push everyone out of the North, push them down into essentially concentration camps in the South, immiserate them, continue to murder them, and hope that eventually some location will be made available for an exodus of the Palestinian people. If the deal holds, it will look less violent. I think there will be less Palestinians killed. It won't be a full-fledged genocide, but it will still be ethnic cleansing. And so you'll still have the IDF carrying out their operations, handing it over to what's called the International Stabilization Force, which is not United Nations Blue Helmets. This International Stabilization Force will be under the command of the American-Israeli Board of Peace that will be chaired by Donald Trump. And the viceroy, the man who will be the colonial administrator of Gaza, will be Tony Blair. And that's who this International Stabilization Force report to. And the idea is to bring in regional troops into Gaza to police and occupy Gaza. And who would those troops be? You know, if it's the Emiratis and the Saudis, we saw what they did in Yemen. I mean, like, so the idea that somehow this is going to be anything other than a proxy force to continue the ethnic cleansing. I just don't understand it. The 20-point peace plan itself is so vague and so generalized that really with the Israelis and the Americans as the determiners in terms of what does it mean for an area to be terror-free? What does it mean for an area to be demilitarized, right? I mean, it's up to them to decide, the Israelis and the Americans, when it is time to stop military operations. And again, it's so vague in general. Yeah. That they can never stay. They have the absolute right by this peace plan to continue military operations indefinitely.
Let me ask you, because we're running a little bit low on time here. What are the possibilities here? What is for the Palestinian side, for example, what is the best case that's rationally possible, and what is the worst case that's rationally possible?
Best case is that they're under a foreign subjugation where they have some degree of limited local control. Aid is being administered, as the deal says, by third parties. So not that Gaza Humanitarian Foundation that's running death traps. They are disguised as aid distribution points. They are able to live lives again in these localized communities as the plan goes forward to either bring in Israeli settlers or to build Trump Towers. I think that's the best case, but at least the genocide is finished and the military actions are infrequent or specific or localized. Still happening, okay.
Before you give me the dark side, let me caveat it with something else or a precursor. I personally cannot imagine not just Netanyahu himself, not just Smotrich or Ben-Gvir, but the whole panoply of Israeli political leaders and many people for that matter. I can't imagine them saying, we've had this opportunity for the first time in the beginning to finally have a shot at expelling them. I can't see any way that they'll settle for just, okay, we'll just freeze everything where it's at and kind of get back to where we were right before all this stuff started. It seems to me that they will do something to make sure that doesn't happen, to continue trying the ethnic cleansing. Get the final word.
Right. And then, and I give that what I just described there as the best case. I give that, if I had to bet a dollar, Danny, I'd put a nickel down on that. I'm looking at a 5 or 10% chance on that. And then the more likely case is when the deal fails and you just resume the ethnic cleansing, whether it's immediately or it's, a decent interval is provided, or the plan goes forward and it's just essentially a different form of subjugation, that it's just a different form of occupation and apartheid. The Palestinians are kept in concentration camps, or the million plus that are on the Al-Mazi neighborhood on the coast there in Rafah, they essentially are living in a ghetto. And between this ghetto and between the concentration camps, there's nothing but desolation. And the apartheid walls and the roads that have been so successful for the Israelis in the West Bank are utilized in Gaza. These areas of these Palestinian areas in Gaza are disconnected from one another. There is no Palestinian governance except for the de facto governance that exists within the camps. I think within the camps, for lack of a better term, I'm not sure what's to call those, what will be, you'll have control either by the Palestinian resistance or possibly by the Palestinian collaborationist gangs that we've seen Israel backing these last 2 years in Gaza. And then you'll have either IDF or International Stabilization Forces killing as they please. And of course, aid, food, medicine, water being utilized to further the subjugation of the people. You can go on in this dystopian manner, right. But I think that's where we're headed.
Let me ask one final question, which is, in my view, the only possible thing that could interdict all of those awful things you're talking about, and that is international response. Now, we've had I think it was 156 countries recognized a Palestinian state here. And I know most of that is just symbolic, but everything's not symbolic. There has been Turkey, for example, they cut off economic aid, Spain cut off military supplies, et cetera. If these things, if this darker version you're talking about starts to manifest, do you see any possibility that the West, like maybe it did with South Africa, not the West, just the rest of the world, not even just the West, might finally start to take some actual concrete actions and try to do something to bring it into this? Do you think there's a possibility of that?
No, I don't believe so.
That's not encouraging.
No, it's not. I don't believe so. I don't think, I think what you'll see is a push by the Americans and the Israelis to paint things as the new normal in Gaza. That the information will be tightly controlled, et cetera. The propaganda campaign, as we're seeing here in the U.S. with, say, the purchase of Paramount and TikTok by Larry and David Ellison, you know, the propaganda efforts by the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs, paying $7,000 to influencers to post on behalf of Israel. Donald Trump's National Security Policy Memorandum number 7, which makes, you know, essentially this conversation, Danny, an act of terrorism, right? I mean, you're going to have those efforts to either buy out or censor voices. And as long as the Americans are backing Israel, then it really doesn't matter. I mean, Israel's a small country. We can continue to support it. Its GDP is, you know, its budget is $60 billion a year. I mean, you can imagine the American Congress providing $10, $20, $30 billion a year in economic assistance, as we did up into the 1970s. We provided a lot of economic assistance to keep Israel afloat and to make sure it would eventually be successful economically. We can do that again. The Israelis understand that. Many Israelis believe in this idea of Fortress Israel, because that's the way that God intended it, that this fits with their cosmic, their biblical, the historical understanding of Israel and the world. Everyone is against us. That's always the way it's been. And some of them embrace this idea. You had Benjamin Netanyahu speaking about a super Sparta. And I think backing all of that as well is this idea that it's only a matter of time till things go back to normal. So if you have the case where, say, the peace plan works, or even the genocide continues, the peace plan fails, the genocide continues, and you get to this position where you have some type of status where the Palestinians are in the camps, they're no longer reducing Gaza the way we've seen it being reduced and destroyed this last 2 years, what's the acceptable number of Palestinians killed every day, every week, every month, so that the Europeans don't get offended? I mean, we've witnessed them kill 20,000 children, the Israelis murder 20,000 children. We've witnessed that for 2 years now. And the actual real actions by the Europeans are insignificant. I mean, yeah, you're right. I mean, so I think that's why I say I have extremely little or no hope for this.
Well, we'll have to see where it goes. All we can do is put forth the truth like we're doing here, and to put in stark contrast the feckless and the, in my view, amoral actions of so many Western governments, to include our own in the complicity in this genocide. And that's what we can do. We can just go make our voices heard and just pray that at some point, God himself intervenes and does something to turn off this insanity. But in any case, I really appreciate you, because you've provided such a depth of knowledge of this that's just not given on mainstream media anywhere. And if people want the truth, they can keep coming here for it. And we really appreciate your willingness to tell the truth, no matter what it is.
All right. Thanks, Danny. I appreciate what you did here today. Again, making sure people understand that this didn't start on October 7th.
Thank you very much, and we appreciate you guys too. Be sure and join us in about 1 hour, because we're going to stick in the Middle East there, and we have Colonel Doug McGregor going to come back and tell us that be careful, because there may be warnings of a new military action against Iran. Some consider that actually inevitable. We'll talk to Doug to find out why people are saying that. Join us today at 12 o'clock Eastern Standard Time on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.